Once again, Iran calls for an impartial implementation of the IAEA safeguards. Tehran says the agency should not yield to Israeli pressure. Based on a new report, the U.S. has stepped up intelligence sharing with Ukraine ahead of Kiev's counteroffensive against Russian forces in the east. Plus, millions of Muslim pilgrims heading toward the Iraqi city of Karbala ahead of Diyar Bayin, which marks 40 days after the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia Imam. Hello everyone, welcome to World News. Here in the Iranian capital, I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Iran slamming a statement in which France, Germany, and Britain raised doubts about the country's sincerity in seeking a nuclear agreement. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says that the step was ill-advised and unconstructive and taken at the wrong time. Kanani said that the trio took the step under Israeli influence. He added that Iran has adopted a positive approach to the Vienna talks and the International Atomic Energy Agency. The spokesman noted that Iran also expects a constructive approach by European countries on the revival of the nuclear deal. The official also called for an impartial implementation of the IAEA safeguards, stressing that the agency should not yield to the Israeli pressure. Journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas believes that the IAEA's treatment of Iran's nuclear work is hypocritical.
The IAEA is not really a credible organization. It's part of the money mafia. It's part of the empire, as it were, the Anglo-Zionist empire. And anything it says and does about Iran in terms of nuclear capacity, etc., is completely hypocritical. It doesn't do any of these inspections on Israel, which has over 400 nuclear weapons, allegedly, and certainly has the has some. The figures vary as to what people indicate they have, but it does nothing in terms of the non-proliferation treaty. It does nothing in terms of inspections of Israel's nuclear arsenal. It doesn't even stop America beginning to nuclearize Saudi Arabia, the other major regional antagonist to Iran. So there's a huge load of hypocrisy from the alliance, which is built up against Iran, from having any even legal nuclear energy access.
The Iranian Army's ground force says its Arash-2 drone is specifically developed for strikes on Israeli cities of Haifa and Tel Aviv. The force's commander says the drone is part of a structure designed to, quote, destroy the Israeli regime. Brigadier General Kumar Sayeri says that the Arash-2 is a unique aircraft with precision strike capability. The general stressed that the ground force is now operating UAVs with strategic ranges of up to 2,000 kilometers. Arash-2 was part of the new weaponry that the force tested during military drills last week. Iran also unveiled a Babil drone, which can carry cruise missiles. Ukraine says its military has recaptured 20 settlements in the past day as it's pushing its offensive against Russian forces in the east. The military is now fighting to gain full control over the territories. Ukraine has been claiming advances against Russia's military in the south and east. Kiev says that the operation has led to the liberation of three key cities. The military also says it's taken back up to 3,000 square kilometers of land from Russia this month. Russia has not confirmed losing territory, but it says it's withdrawing forces from the northeastern Kharkiv region for regrouping. Now, in the meantime, the United States is providing Ukraine with intelligence to help its forces launch counteroffensives against Russian forces more effectively, and that according to media reports citing senior U.S. officials. We've discussed that issue in our News Review program. Ukrainian officials have used U.S. intelligence in an ongoing counteroffensive that resulted in gains against the Russian forces in the northeastern Kharkiv region. The New York Times cited unnamed senior American officials as saying that Kiev stepped up intelligence sharing with Washington before the operation that has started on Thursday. According to the report, the U.S. provided Ukraine with information about Russian military positions and their weaknesses. Kyiv claims its recent offensive has led to the liberation of some 3,000 square kilometers of territory. Russia has also confirmed the drawdown of some of its forces from the area. It says it's regrouping troops to bolster efforts along the Donetsk front. Russia has frequently warned the U.S. against providing weapons and sharing intelligence with Ukraine and said that Washington risks becoming a party to the conflict. Okay, let me invite a couple of guests to discuss this a bit further. Dmitry Zolotarev is a journalist in Irkutsk, Russia. Also, John Stepling, author and commentator, is joining me from Indre, Norway. Good to see you, gentlemen. So, Dmitry, is Washington not already a party to the conflict in the Ukraine war?
The Washington have been a party of the conflict for years. It has been collaborating with Ukraine, exchanging intelligence information since forever. Mm-hmm. So there is nothing new. They just a little bit intensified exchanging of information for the last days, which have resulted with even more catastrophe to the Ukraine. I can explain that.
Okay. And John, it's evident that the U.S. wants this flames of war, you know, to keep burning in Ukraine. Give us some insight as to the reasons why Washington wants this to go on, despite all the claims the war is bad and all that jazz.
Right. Well, look, if you put this in any kind of historical perspective, your other guest is right. They've been interfering with Russian affairs for decades, but in 96 they very specifically worked overtime to make sure Yeltsin got elected. They openly admit this. They made a Hollywood movie about it called Spinning Boris. Then later, of course, the 2014 coup, which was directly aided and funded and orchestrated by the United States. And this is seen as okay. But you have to remember, I have to emphasize that the Western populations read mainstream news. The New York Times has a big story about this particular topic, that the U.S. and Ukraine are sharing information. Of course they are. They've been sharing information since 2014. And this is nothing new. But nothing you read in the New York Times has any relationship to the truth. I mean, it's simply a propaganda organ of the U.S. government. And this has to be underscored and emphasized. The New York Times is not a legitimate news organization. Neither is the Washington Post, the LA Times, et cetera, et cetera. And so the level of Russophobia in these media outlets is kind of breathtaking. You will never hear a good word said about Russia, either the people, the culture, or the government, certainly not Putin. Much as you never hear anything good about Iran, you never hear anything good about the government in Venezuela, et cetera, et cetera. The U.S. has been violating international law for decades. I mean, it's almost frustrating to talk about. They have drone assassinations. They cooperate with Saudi Arabia in a war in Yemen that is genocidal. They cooperate with Israel, assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists. All the way back to the 1950s, they were killing African liberation leaders like Patrice Lumumba.
Yep.
Everybody knows this. So nothing you read bears any relationship to the truth. Yeah. And the U.S., yes, is already a party to this conflict. They have been for years.
And the funny thing is, for only one of those reasons that you said the U.S. has been doing, just for one of them is enough for a regime change elsewhere in the world.
Absolutely.
That is okay for the U.S. Now, Dmitry, 3,000 kilometers of, you know, chunk of land, that's what Russians have lost. This is big deal, okay? Okay, how far is the U.S. weaponry, intelligence sharing, whatever is concerned? So, given the circumstances, the Washington, D.C.
is not
going to stop backing Ukraine. It doesn't matter how, by providing arms directly or intelligence sharing. So what's the prospect like regarding the Ukraine war?
The prospect is the doom of Ukraine, nothing else. First of all, thanks to my well-respected counterpart here, another guest, John, he is absolutely right. The thing is that all the Ukraine has achieved just bought a franchise from the United States, which is called the Butcher Shop. You know, the casualties mm-hmm. of last few days, 4,000 troops dead, 8,000 of Ukrainian troops wounded. Can you call that a counter-offensive? No, sir, I can't. This is sending troops to a meat grinder. Look how they how this so-called counter-offensive goes. They just entered this area of Russian-controlled area without a fight. They just entered the empty space, which says about what? The Russians getting them into tactical ambush. They just like fishing with the bottle. Uh-huh. The fish goes into the bottle, and what Russians do? They block the bottleneck and boil the fish. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Okay.
So this is no counter-offense there. It's just a tactical ambush with no flanks deep into Russian-controlled territory. Mm-hmm. A huge ambush, which the Russians have kept doing this for months, and it just worked as a meat grinder for the Ukrainian army. They are getting to their doom.
All right.
And so Russian army will smash the Ukrainian troops, within upcoming days.
Okay. Thank you so much for the insight and contribution, Dmitry Zalatarov in Irkutsk, Russia, and John Stepeling in Indre, Norway. Welcome back. Let's move on. Iraqi border officials say that more than 3 million pilgrims have entered the country for the annual commemoration of Erbain. The flow of pilgrims traveling to Iraq has reportedly been smooth. Every year, millions of people, many of them from Iran, walk toward the city of Karbala, which hosts the shrine of Imam Hussein. And that's to mark 40 days since the Imam's martyrdom anniversary. The governor says that they're expecting over 20 million pilgrims to visit the province this year. The pilgrimage, that's one of the largest religious congregations in the world, reaches its peak on the day of Erbain that falls on the 17th of September this year. Now, 1 year after the Taliban's takeover, Afghanistan is facing a spiraling economic and humanitarian crisis. The Taliban blamed the United States for the dire situation in that country, calling on Washington to release frozen Afghan assets. Our correspondent reports from Kabul.
After 1 year under the Taliban control, Afghanistan is on the brink of economic collapse. This is according to the latest update by the World Food Program. The UN body says the economic crisis wiped out jobs, salaries, and livelihoods across Afghanistan, limiting people's purchasing power. The WFP has called on the international community to step up its efforts before winter to avert a humanitarian catastrophe.
Today, I came to the bazaar to buy some food. As I checked the prices and the money in my pocket, I couldn't afford a sack of rice. I'm sure others are facing the same situation. We call on the Taliban and the international community to take steps towards fixing Afghanistan's worsening economy.
Here on a Kabul street, Afghans sell household items to escape poverty and keep food on the plate. These people say it's a matter of survival for them. They are also concerned about their future.
We are just trying to survive in this difficult economic situation. We are forced to sell our belongings and household items to put bread on the table. Some are selling second-hand items to pay their debt and bills, since they have been unemployed for months. I don't know what I will do in the coming month to make ends meet.
The Taliban deputy economy minister blamed the economic crisis on 2 decades of U.S. occupation and Washington's sanctions on the war-ravaged country.
Today's deteriorating economic situation in our country is a legacy of the U.S. invasion, because the U.S. never let Afghan national economic bodies grow or become self-sufficient. All the U.S. did was to keep Afghanistan a consumer country and dependent on U.S. aid. Likewise, after the withdrawal, the U.S. seized Afghanistan's assets and cut international funding. As a result, the U.S. is to blame for Afghanistan's fragile economy.
In the meantime, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs has announced that 25 million people in Afghanistan are living in poverty, and 19 million people are facing food insecurity. Recent earthquakes and floods have added to the sufferings, by damaging thousands of houses and affecting livelihoods. More and more Afghans continue to suffer from high unemployment, reduced salaries, and rising food prices. Meanwhile, international bodies are calling on donors to restore funding for Afghanistan as another harsh winter is approaching. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The Turkish defense minister says that four soldiers have been killed in fresh clashes with Kurdish militants in northern Iraq. It says the fighting erupted as forces were conducting a cross-border operation. Turkey launches frequent air raids and ground incursions into Iraq against militants of Kurdistan Workers' Party, PKK. Now, these are part of Operation Clawlock that Ankara launched in April to stem what it calls Kurdish terrorism in northern Iraq. Baghdad has condemned the offensive as a violation of its sovereignty. Voters in the Japanese prefecture of Okinawa have re-elected incumbent Denny Tamaki as governor. He's against U.S. military presence on the island. Tamaki's win is expected to be officially announced after exit polls put him in the lead with 51% of the vote on Sunday. The governor is backed by a coalition of opposition parties, is opposed to a plan by the central government in Tokyo to relocate the U.S. Marine base in Okinawa to a less populated area of the prefecture. Tamaki wants the base to be closed for good. The Fotenma base in Okinawa hosts the majority of the U.S.'s 50,000 troops and its military infrastructure in Japan. Locals have resented the U.S. military presence since a series of scandals that involved American troopers raping and murdering Okinawans. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseinia on July 27, 2022.
When I said there were people who stood up firmly against arrows and swords, but they were struck down when it came to suspicions and doubts, worldly greed is somewhat involved in this. This should also be taken into consideration. What world or dunya do we mean? Each person's world or dunya is different. One person's dunya is their wealth. Someone else's dunya is their position. Another person's dunya is their lusts. Different people have different worlds, dunyas, and these are all considered to be worldly desires. People may try to justify these desires, but they are still worldly greed. These also play a part. So, as I said, the Friday prayer sermons should be fundamental and focused on presenting rich content and strong logic concerning the essential issues of the revolution, such as justice. Justice is a very important issue. Think about it, work on it, speak about it. Also speak about independence, independence is a very important matter. The issues of supporting the underprivileged and uniting the world of Islam are also very significant issues. Give people awareness and insight.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
These things that I have mentioned are also true for the upcoming Muharram sermons, and you should be able to see the results in the following Friday prayers. So, if what you're doing is successful, you should be able to see it in the people coming to the Friday prayers. If you notice that what you're doing was not effective in attracting a larger audience, there is something wrong with what you're doing. Find those flaws and fix them. We cannot say the reason for this lack of attention is that people have lost their beliefs and have become less religious. Some people say such things. It truly seems they are talking without having thought about what they're saying and are suggesting that the people have become less religious. No, that's not the case at all. They're not less religious. Just look at the Ghadir celebrations and the massive gatherings for the ceremonies and speeches during the months of Muharram and Safar. Who are the people who attend these ceremonies? They are our people. Look at the morning ceremonies, the religious ceremonies, the Arba'een Wuk. Who are these people? These are our people.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Iran's top general has warned of the ramifications of the growing military coordination between the U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, and the Israeli military, saying the Islamic Republic interprets the development as a direct threat to its national security. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Baghdadi, wrote in an online message that the terrorist U.S. military has tried to compensate for the withdrawal of its aircraft carriers, helicopter carriers, and destroyers from the Persian Gulf and the Oman Sea by connecting the child-killing Israeli military to CENTCOM.
The meaning of this action is that, from our point of view, the spying and even operational facilities of the United States and its allies will be at the disposal of the occupying Zionist regime, and this will increase the threat to our beloved country.
In his message, Baghdadi also said the regional countries that host American forces have already received written warnings from Iran, which sees the U.S. presence in the region as a serious threat.
In addition to written announcements, warnings, and conveyance of the message through the foreign ministry to countries hosting the U.S. Army, We have declared and will declare our readiness and warning through expanding our presence, including air and sea patrols, deepening our intelligence dominance, and conducting various naval, missile, and drone exercises.
The top Iranian general further said, Iran's friendly advice to neighboring countries is to uphold brotherly relations and cooperation to establish security in the region by our own countries and not by relying on foreigners. Israel moved from U.S. European command to CENTCOM in September of last year, with the aim of simplifying the cooperation with American occupation forces in the region. The move is also expected to expand military coordination between the Israeli regime and sub-Arab countries, which began to normalize their relations with the regime in Tel Aviv under U.S. brokered agreements in late 2020.
So this is really a response by the West, by the U.S., British, Canadian, Australian, Five Eyes military alliance, in an almost nervous reaction to their failed, not only their failed operations in the Middle East, from Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya to Syria, but they're also now seeing their failure in Ukraine, which is going to result in tremendous political uprisings that most likely will overthrow the ruling regimes in Europe. So I think Israel and the United States may very well try and open up a new military front against Syria, against Iran, using Iraq as a proxy. And this is the first step in that strategy.
Late last month, Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, made an unprecedented visit to the headquarters of the U.S. Central Command in Florida. During the visit, Gantz claimed that Israel's cooperation with CENTCOM and the countries of the region is a game-changer in confronting Iran, adding that Israel and the U.S. will continue to deepen cooperation against Iran's peaceful nuclear program, which he charged was aimed at obtaining a nuclear weapon, a baseless accusation that Tehran has time and again rejected. Washington has also been working to improve ties between Israel and its neighbors under the U.S. brokered Abraham Accords. The deal, commonly described as normalizing relations and establishing formal diplomatic ties between the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, and Israel. At its heart, a business deal, the Abraham Accords facilitated financial investment between the countries as well as military and surveillance cooperation. Palestinian leaders, activists, and ordinary people have repeatedly rejected Arab-Israeli normalization deals as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people.
The shifting political powers in Europe and the world and the Middle East are driving the Israeli reaction. Very clearly, the pendulum of political power is shifting away from the United States and Britain and Israel, and it is shifting into Asia. So you have Russia, India, Iran, China emerging as the powerhouse countries. And Israel recognizes that the Middle Eastern regimes of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, they are all shifting to seek better relations with Russia. That being said, Israel is quickly accelerating its military plans to try and bluff and seem like it is a threat. But I think at heart, it recognizes these Middle Eastern regimes of the Wahhabi Sunni kingdoms have no political loyalty whatsoever.
Normalization is the way for the current regimes to establish their foundations and fight their peoples by transforming the battle in our region from a struggle for Palestinian and Arab rights to supporting the ambitions and plans of the occupation. In the absence of outlets for oppressed Palestinians to resist and tell their narratives, social media are one of the few tools at their disposal to counter Israeli disinformation campaigns. However, social media platforms, which were once heralded as means of free speech and liberation, have been complicit in the suppression and silencing of pro-Palestinian voices, a practice dubbed digital apartheid by some. Israel's attempts to erase the humanity of the Palestinians or whitewash its crimes against them continue unabated. Facebook's massive media monopoly, rebranded as Meta to save face from years of controversies surrounding it, is one of Israel's favorite ways to censor and control political debate in Palestine. Now, in a fresh crackdown on Palestinian social media content, several platforms owned by Meta have targeted accounts of dozens of pro-Palestinian individuals, including activists, writers, and journalists. Facebook and WhatsApp have closed many accounts for covering Israel's August bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip and reporting on Palestinian civilian deaths. The targeted individuals have raised the alarm over what they describe as unjust suppression of their content. They say the social networking platforms have cited breaching their publishing standards for the crackdown.
I posted a number of photos detailing the civilians killed by Israeli forces in the Gaza Strip on August 17. They then accused me of breaching the publishing standards. But the real reason is clear. It's about cleansing the platforms of Palestinian content.
My first warning came when I published a photo of Adam Nablusi, who was killed by occupying forces. I was suspended from posting or commenting for 30 days while my posts were reviewed. I believe that the closure of my WhatsApp account is about stopping me publishing my journalistic work.
Sada Social, an initiative that records and monitors the suspension of Palestinian content and accounts on social media platforms, announced that Meta had mainly targeted activists based in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Nida Basumi, the media coordinator at Sada Social, says there has been an agreement in place between the Israeli regime and major social media networks since 2016 over controlling Palestinian content. She also pointed to double standards imposed by Meta when it comes to censoring content.
It launched an intensive campaign against Palestinian journalists by restricting social media posts reporting breaking news from Palestine. But it did not restrict the Israeli forces' video showing them raiding Nablus and killing Palestinians.
Israel and its allies are not only pressuring big tech to silence pro-Palestinian voices from outside. Facebook's Oversight Board, an independent body tasked with deliberating on the platform's content decisions, includes a former official at an Israeli ministry cyber unit, Emmy Palmer. She personally lobbied for the removal of thousands of pieces of Palestinian content from Facebook.
You know, it happens to all journalists all over the world, to all people who are pro-Palestinian all over the world. We have to fight with that. It's not only the Palestinian social media. It's all social media and all the people that ignore the narrative and are trying to do their jobs right. It's all the people that try to communicate a truth that the narrative doesn't like, the main narrative.
Since the very beginning, social media companies have collaborated with centers of power in the U.S. They even collaborated with the U.S. Department of Defense on surveillance and big data analysis. So it's not just a few influential pro-Israeli voices co-opting social media companies into silencing pro-Palestinian voices. The industry itself is rotten to its core.
As the crisis between Russia and the West continues to get worse, Moscow's warnings against the West for its punitive measures against the Kremlin continue to get tough. President Putin has now warned that Western sanctions against his country are hurting the entire world. Putin described the sanctions as short-sighted, saying the West has undermined the global economy with its aggressive attempts to impose its dominance on the world.
The United States has been pressing sanctions against Russia, individuals, private businesses, and state-owned enterprises. The European countries, most of which belong to the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, have gone along with this and have imposed their own sanctions. They're trying to cut back on the importation of Russian gas, because that provides revenue for the Russian government. But they seem to have suddenly remembered that they import 30% of their gas from Russia.
Putin also said the West has been reluctant to recognize that, quote, irreversible and tectonic shifts have occurred in international relations. According to Putin, these shifts in international relations have led to the emergence of the Asia-Pacific region as a magnet for human resources, capital, and production capacities. The Russian president further said that Moscow found more opportunities in the markets in the Middle East after the West imposed sanctions on Russia. Putin also attributed the unfolding global economic crisis to Western elites who, quote, would not or even cannot acknowledge objective facts about global changes. He further said the US and its Western allies have tried to isolate Russia, but, according to Putin, it's impossible to isolate Moscow from the global economic and political landscape.
The problem for the United States ruling class at this point is that the world is becoming increasingly multipolar. It's no longer a situation where the United States can call the shots every area politically, economically, and even militarily. China is the second, the world's second largest economy, and is that economy is advancing more rapidly than that of the United States, and the United States views this as a tremendous threat because it's an economic competitor. The United States has been involved in wars throughout its history, but certainly intensely ever since World War II.
The crisis between the West and Russia has triggered unprecedented shifts in international alliances. After the war broke out between Russia and Ukraine, the US and its European allies tried to put Russia into a corner by imposing a raft of sanctions against Moscow. They put Russia's oil and gas industries, as well as its banking and insurance sectors, under heavy sanction. But the sanctions now appear to have backfired against Europe. Following the tensions, oil and gas prices surged to unprecedented levels. The high prices were beneficial to Russia, bringing huge profits to its oil and gas sector. Furthermore, Russia has forged closer ties with China, India, and Iran.
So, and meanwhile, Russia is now selling more oil to China and India at reduced cost, but they're selling it. So it looks like the sanctions are not going to hurt Russia nearly to the extent that the West hoped it would, and they're having repercussions on the standard of living of Europeans and North Americans, which only goes to show how integrated we are into a global economy. The sanctions are not producing the effect that the West wanted to. It's not bringing Russia to its knees, and it is also having deleterious effects on their own economies and their own peoples. So I think in that sense, President Putin was correct in his analysis.
Furthermore, the crisis put European countries into uncharted territory. Gas prices are rising dramatically in Europe following Russia's decision to stop gas exports to Europe. Moscow has cited Western sanctions as the reason for its decision and says it will not resume gas flow until Western sanctions are lifted. The energy crunch is now hurting European countries. There are now warnings of a harsh winter in Europe. There are already protests in several European countries against high costs of living and soaring prices. High electricity prices are hurting ordinary citizens in Europe as well as major businesses. Germany, which is considered Europe's biggest economy, is now on the brink of recession. Experts now warn that an economic downturn in Germany is unavoidable. And the recession in Germany will surely negatively affect the economy of the entire European Union.
It could have been dismissed as just another blast, but this was anything but that. An explosion at the entrance of the Russian embassy in the Afghan capital, which killed two Russian embassy staff members along with many civilians. The IS Khorasan or Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility, and this is where this attack is different from the others that Daesh has executed. This is the first attack claimed by the Daesh on a diplomatic mission in Afghanistan after the Taliban took over the country in 2021. This is important in many respects. The terrorist group first emerged in Syria and Iraq. It was a well-known fact that the U.S. and its allies supported the group, especially in Syria.
And so it seems that Daesh, which was very likely actually created by the U.S. Military intelligence community, is once again serving as the sort of American Arab Legion. And they have, you know, they've never showed up anywhere outside of the sort of the Syria-Iraq region before. But just as the Taliban was making big progress in Afghanistan, suddenly Daesh came along and started attacking the Taliban and spreading chaos.
But then alarming news surfaced last year that they had moved to Afghanistan from the West Asia and posed a threat to regional security. The SCO last year raised the alarm when it announced that these terrorists were moved from Syrian and Iraqi conflict zones and posed a threat to the SCO member states. The Hezbollah Secretary General echoed the same sentiments. Said Hassan Nasrallah stated that according to reports he had received, the U.S.'s exit from Afghanistan pointed to Washington's role in transferring Daesh's terrorists from Iraq and the eastern bank of the Euphrates River to Afghanistan.
So this is a typical situation in which the U.S. government has done this all over the world in dozens of countries. They create terrorism to spread chaos in order to try to discredit the regime that they want to overthrow or hobble. And in this case, the reasons are obvious. The U.S. wants to win the great game. It wants to occupy the center of the grand chessboard in the struggle for Eurasia, as Brzezinski said. And it's losing, and it's trying to essentially win the war in Afghanistan by other means through supporting this obviously false flag terrorist group, so-called Daesh, which is purely and simply an American front.
It's now widely believed that the U.S., despite its hasty and disastrous departure from Afghanistan, still has plans for the resource-rich country. Iran's special representative for Afghanistan says even though the United States has withdrawn from Afghanistan, it supports terrorist groups such as Daesh to continue its role in the region. The Daesh and other Takfiri terrorist groups, in fact, continue the role of American soldiers in the region. I believe this is a real proxy war. We witnessed the same thing in Iraq and Syria. After its defeat in Iraq, the United States replaced its own forces with other groups to pursue the American goals in the region. There are speculations that given the backing of the U.S., this group will continue with its violence in Afghanistan. But what is their gain? For starters, the group's intention behind creating instability in Afghanistan may be to draw Iran into a conflict. It is a well-known fact that Iran is their number one enemy.
That they organized it around a kind of really extremist Salafi Wahhabi interpretation of Islam, or even really off, more extreme than even Salafi Wahhabis. And so they essentially took an element of thought from within sort of the more extremist people in Saudi Arabia and raised that to the nth power to create these total fanatics who are brainwashed into believing that they're right, everybody else is wrong, so everybody else needs their head chopped off. And the first people that whose heads they want to chop off are Shia Muslims. And that's very convenient for the U.S. because the U.S. is waging war not only against Russia and China, but also against Iran and the Axis of Resistance.
And given that the group had targeted the Russian embassy, it might want to provoke Russia into this scenario, which could turn Afghanistan into another Syria. Then there is the relationship between Daesh and the Taliban, which remains somewhat murky. At this point, the Taliban should be in charge of security for embassies, but they had failed with regards to Russia. And last year, even though the Taliban have publicly stated that there is no cooperation with the group, the country's neighbors like Iran will be watching Daesh terrorist group's actions very closely and how the Taliban deal with eradicating this terrorist group from the country.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
You're listening to Hosseinia from IRIB English Radio by Sayyed Abbas Rezavian. Labaik ya Hussein.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alayka ya Abba Abdullah. Peace and salutations upon you, Imam Hussein alayhi salam. I send my condolences for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We were talking about benefiting from Ziyarat al-Ashura and reciting it and incorporating it in our personal and spiritual lives. We talked about the final position that when someone acts upon Ziyarat al-Ashura, they reach, and that is al-Maqam al-Mahmud. And that's something that we ask Allah to give us in such a time period and other time periods when we recite this ziyarat. We talked about one of the most important aspects of this position, and that is a person starts developing the faculty of a ma'rafa binuraniya, meaning that they start seeing and witnessing things through light. Because the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam are light, they're nur. Before creation, we have many traditions from all sects in Islam, all madhahib in Islam, that they say that the Prophet and Imam Ali were light thousands of years before Adam was created. This is hadith al-nur, the hadith and the tradition of light. And this is not limited only to the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. In other groups of Islam, they believe in this tradition, maybe 50 sources from other schools of thought. So the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam are light, nur. We look at ziyarat at Jamir Kabira, one of the important ziyarats. It says, خَلَغَكُمُ اللَّهُ أَنْوَارًا. God has created you, the Ahlul Bayt, as light. فَجَعَلَكُمْ بَأَرْشِهِ مُهْتَقِينَ. He then made you observe from his throne. You were around his throne. You were around the arsh. حَتَّ مَنَّ عَلَيْنَا بِكُمْ. Until he favored us with your presence and brought you down from where you were around the arsh of God, and you were light, and they brought you to this world. Therefore, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam are nur. Their majalis that we have, the majalis of Imam Hussein, the gatherings, the congregations we have for Imam Hussein, they are light. Their shrines are light. When a person reaches their shrines, it is full of light, but it takes a heart that is able to distinguish light and darkness, to be able to deal and cope and witness this nur and light. We are in need of light. We are in need of nur. When we pray, when we do salat, when we remember God, light comes and showers our hearts. When we separate from Him, when we separate from His commands, when we separate from His prophets and their successors, we are in absolute darkness. It's like pulling away light from the socket. And when you take out the cord, what happens? We stop shining. Therefore, as long as we're connected to God, we will have light. Our hearts will have light. This ma'rifat binuraniyat is in our traditions. We talked about the tradition of Salman and Abu Dharr when they approached Imam Ali, and he told them that this is Deen al-Khalis, this is the pure religion. If you understand Imam Ali, If you understand the imams through light, through nur, this is pure religion. In another tradition we have from Imam Hadi alayhi salam, that when he became the imam, it says in this tradition, "Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un," he says, "we are from God and for surely to God we'll return." And they asked him, "Faqila lahu wa kayfa araft?" How did you know that your father Abu Ja'far, Imam Jawad, passed away? How did you know? He says this in the tradition, "Qala la'annahu tadakhalani dhillatun lillah lam akun a'rafuha." I felt humility. I felt a weight, a humility that I did not understand this or feel this before. I felt the weight and the humility of imamat on me. So this is another proof that there's ma'rifat bin nuraniyat, that you can be able to know the imams through light, through nur. And inshallah, we will connect to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We will connect to our imams, inshallah, and develop this nur, because this is Deen al-Khalis. This is the pure religion. And when you know the Ahlul Bayt, you will know God. Bina urifa Allah. Through us, God is known.
Standing here alone on a land so far from home, a place where angels cry, while innocent children die. Hussein said goodbye, praying some of them survive the torture and the heat. They can't bear to watch him leave. They cry out, "Hussein, ya Hussein."
Realizing and understanding the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam through nur and light. This is something that is very possible to do, and is something that has been done in history. We have in one of our traditions, a group of people from Yemen, a group of worshippers, good people, they came to the Prophet inquiring about his successor. So the Prophet gave him a verse of the Quran, and they kept asking, then, "Who is this? Who is this Hablullah? You attach yourselves to the rope of God." And then they kept asking, and finally he says, basically, "Go out in the lines of Salat, in congregation Salat, and find, you will find him yourself. See who your heart inclines towards." So they began to walk, this group of Yemeni worshippers. They began to walk and walk, and then they saw one person that they were sure that was their successor, the successor of the Holy Prophet. So they come back to him, and he says, "Is it him?" And then the Prophet says, "Yes." You know, he affirms the fact that it is Ali ibn Abi Talib, it is Imam Ali. And he asks him, "How did you know?" And the Yemenis in this hadith, they say that in this tradition, they began crying and saying, "Oh, Messenger of God, we looked at the people, but our hearts did not incline to any of them. When we saw this man, our hearts trembled, and then our souls felt assured. Our eyes shed tears, and chests became pleased, as if he was our father, and we were his children." So these worshippers, they understood who the successor, who deserved imamat after the Holy Prophet. Who was the imam after the Holy Prophet, the guide, the leader, the guardian? And why? Through ma'rifat nuraniyat. That is how they did this. And then it says that the Prophet of Islam later on talked about how these people would follow and predicted that they would follow Imam Ali, and this was true. They continued and were loyal to Imam Ali, and many of them fought with him, alongside Imam Ali against in the Battle of Safin, in the Battle of Jamal, they participated and were martyred in such battles. So this is a hadith that shows us that you have the ability to see and witness nur and light of imamat through your hearts. And when we reach this maqam al-mahmud, inshallah, that we see, that we said in Ziyarat Ashura, we connect to the imams with this nur and light, and we start, inshallah, becoming part of them and like them, inshallah.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will look at the unprecedented and devastating floods in Pakistan and the resulting crises. And we shall also discuss Sri Lanka's attempt at receiving a loan from the IMF and its impact on the country's economy.
This year's monsoon rains have hit Pakistan hard, causing the worst flooding in the past 30 years. Extreme heat waves and monsoon winds led to unprecedented rainfall that submerged millions of acres of farms in water. Now, a third of Pakistan is underwater, and the consequences of this crisis are affecting all aspects of life for the people. Pakistan, which was already struggling with political turmoil and economic hardships, is now facing a series of humanitarian crises and environmental disasters.
Pakistan is ranked 8th in the list of countries most at risk of being a victim of global climate change. This year, it witnessed a 780% increase in average rainfall compared to the past three decades. Extreme heat, high humidity, and glacial meltdowns, in addition to widespread poverty in the country, have led the country to a deadly crisis. Villages are disappearing in the water one after the other, and more than a million houses are in ruins. The death toll has passed 1,200, while more than 33 million people have lost their homes. Pakistan was already troubled with not just political problems, but a range of economic issues such as high inflation, currency devaluation, and a budget deficit. Now, with the devastation of farms and vital infrastructure such as roads, bridges, schools, hospitals, and public health infrastructure, food prices and supply chain issues are expected to follow, with the possibility of viral disease epidemics. A crisis that, according to Pakistani officials, was caused by irresponsible environmental policies applied elsewhere in the world, especially in wealthier nations.
The recent floods in Pakistan has caused major crises in two sectors, food and health. The country's prime minister has estimated more than $10 billion in the loss of infrastructure, homes and farms, and thus requested aid from the global community. The UN Refugee Agency has demanded $160 million to cover the cost of relief projects for Pakistani flood victims. The majority of the victims are predominantly poor villagers who are not just at the risk of hunger, but viral diseases as well.
In 2022, Pakistan experienced an extraordinary heat wave. Most of the cities in the country experienced an average of 40 degrees Celsius temperature. This excessive heat